All right, thank you. Thanks everybody for sticking around this morning. My name is John Wallace. I'm a postdoc in the Weed Management Lab at Penn State. I'm going to be talking today about the potential to utilize residual herbicide programs while still being able to interseed or relay plant cover crops into grain corn production systems in the mid-Atlantic region. This is a small component of a much larger study that was funded by the NRCS-TIG. That looked at all the agronomic factors related to this interseeding system, and it was a collaborative effort between Penn State and the Sustainable Cropping Systems Lab at both Cornell and the Beltsville ARS station. So adoption rates of cover cropping are increasing, especially in the Northeast and Mid-Atlantic region, and this would contain a lot of vegetable-based annual cropping systems, but as well as grain-based systems. So in Pennsylvania, which is really a dairy state, as of 2012, about 15% of the annual croplands received some type of cover crop. And so in Pennsylvania, our annual cropping systems, grain systems are really, there's two types, either cash grain operations that are growing grains in a 2 to 3 year rotation, or dairy systems, which will typically grow grains in a 2 to 3 years and then rotate to alfalfa for a couple years. So we all know that there's multiple agronomic benefits to the farmer in cover cropping, a number of ecosystem services that cover crops provide. Surveys suggest that farmers in our region are really most interested in cover cropping for soil health benefits. And so typically we're dealing with no-till farmers. They're interested in increasing organic matter, preventing soil erosion. And our dairy farmers are also interested in utilizing cover crops for nutrient management. So having a living cover crop in late fall or early spring allows them to spread a little bit more manure and keep some nitrogen in the system. Despite all these benefits, there's really one large constraint to seeing even greater increases in cover crop adoption, and that is that we just have a very narrow growing season in late fall to establish cover crop. And this is really more pronounced as you kind of go north out of the Delmarva region in southern Pennsylvania to central Pennsylvania and New York. It becomes even more problematic. We have a much shorter growing season. And it's really pronounced in grain corn. So typically in our area, we might start harvesting grain corn in mid-October, and that would probably continue up through this time, up through Thanksgiving. So very narrow growing season for establishing cover crops in the fall. So Penn State's response to this real constraint for cover crop adoption has been to develop this interseeder, and so this interseeder is really a high clearance no-till grain drill, and so this was developed about 5 or 6 years ago by a team of Penn State faculty and farm staff. And so this grain drill would have three double disc openers between corn rows on 30-inch row spacing. So the units would be on seven and a half inch row spacing. And what research has really showed over the number of years in which this is tested is that the optimal timing for interseeding is the V5 to V7 growth stage, which this picture shows. And so that's the timing at which we consistently can establish cover crops, and the cover crops normally have pretty good success in overwintering. It's also a timing where we don't see yield penalties from having the cover crop there. And that's often the first question that we get when we talk to farmers about interseeding is the potential for seeing some yield drag or yield penalties. And so I just want to point you to a poster or an abstract that was here this week by Roth et al. That kind of details the performance of interseeded systems. So what we've also found is, as far as what cover crop species really work in this type of system, as far as legume species, medium red clover seems to be the most consistent as far as establishment. And typically we go out at 10 to 15 pounds per acre. And then for establishing a grass interseeding, annual ryegrass has been really the most effective species, and that would be about 15 to 20 pounds per acre. And so both of those, if you're just drilling those single species alone, that's about a $20 per acre seed cost. And so those are really the real workhorses that we found in the system. There are other species that seem to have some potential for interseeding. Forage radish does okay. Orchard grass does quite well. And so I wanted to direct you to another poster that was here this week by Caswell et al. That really details some different trials on different cover crop species and mixes and cultivars. So after we answer questions to farmers about potential yield drag, the next question often is, well, what herbicides can I use? Because farmers realize that there's going to be potential for residual carryover to the cover crops where they could see some injury to the cover crops. And really there's not a lot of good information on herbicide labels about the recropping interval for the suite of cover crops that we're now using. There's some limited information about species like cereal rye, but for annual ryegrass or for some of the clovers that we're using, there's just not a lot of good information. And if it is addressed in the herbicide labels, often it's in the context of a late fall planting or the following spring. And interseeding is a whole different ball game, because V5 to V7 is about, in our area, about 40 days after planting, so 40 days after we'd be putting down a residual herbicide. At planting, we would be coming back and interseeding. And so what we need to find out is where on the dissipation curve, the breakdown and degradation of these soil residual herbicides is 40 days. And so it's going to be a big difference whether it's here, where there's some safety, some crop safety to the cover crops, versus somewhere higher on the curve. And so this is really hard to predict, because we know there's a lot of interacting factors that contribute to dissipation rates, soil factors, texture, organic matter, clay content, soil pH, and all these soil factors are mediated by the environmental conditions in any given year, so soil temperature and soil moisture. And so that's difficult to predict, because in any given year, you can go from one field to the next, and these curves can be quite different. Or you could go back to the same field and use the same herbicide in two different years and see pretty different dissipation rates with soil residual herbicides. We also don't really know too much about what the sensitivity of the cover crops are to these residual herbicides. We know that plant species differ in their ability to metabolize and detoxify these herbicides after plant uptake. And so there would be some benefit to knowing if there's some differences between cover crop species relative to the different soil residual herbicides that we use and what the phytotoxic levels are. So our approach has been to look at both of those factors. And so we're conducting field trials across multiple sites, and we're also conducting greenhouse bioassays to address this issue of what that phytotoxicity level is. But for time purposes, I'm just going to focus on the field trials that we've been conducting. So we've, over the past 3 years, we've conducted field trials mostly at two Penn State facilities, one in southern Pennsylvania and one more in central PA. We also have our Beltsville location and our Cornell locations. We don't have all the data yet, so the data I'm going to present today is over 6 site years. At the completion of the study, we'll have 10 different site years. And that's going to give us a range of soil types. We're really silt loam soils in Pennsylvania. Soils become a little lighter as you go down in Maryland at the Beltsville location. And we'll have some heavier soils at the Cornell location. And so just for the field trials that I'm going to talk about today, pH ranged between 6.5 and 6.9. That's pretty typical for our area. Organic matter somewhere in the twos. Also pretty typical for no-till grain operations in Pennsylvania. Dairies, you may see some higher organic matter content. We were hoping for some different years that would be to our benefit to see some differences across site years as far as the relative amounts of precipitation and differences in temperatures. And so this just demonstrates that we've gotten a little bit of separation between site years as far as what those temperatures and soil moisture conditions would look like from planting or application of the residual herbicides up through interseeding. So the way these field trials were laid out, they were all conducted in no-till fields. We utilized a Roundup Ready system. And so typically we planted somewhere in the middle of May. And prior to planting, we used a burn down application of glyphosate only. We'd come in and apply our suite of residual herbicide treatments. And we did this typical small plot type of study, 10 by 30 foot plots, walked them on with a hand boom sprayer, arranged in a randomized complete block design, 4 reps. And then we came in with a second pass, so we treated this as a 2-pass system where we came in about 3 weeks with another pass of glyphosate, and shortly thereafter we then interseeded. And so we really limited our interseeding to the two workhorses as far as species, medium red clover and annual ryegrass, both at 15 pounds per acre. And we either basically replicated these as two different trials where we either interseeded red clover or annual ryegrass, or we treated them as split plots where we used a 2-row interseeder to do 2 rows of annual ryegrass or 2 rows of medium red clover. As far as data collection, we did visual observations of stand establishment about 4 weeks after interseeding. And then we came in prior to grain harvest and collected cover crop biomass, a couple quarter or half meter square quadrats per plot. And the data I'm going to talk about, or the analysis I'm going to show today, we basically just took the biomass and expressed it as a proportion of the untreated check. And so, and then took the proportional difference from the untreated check and ran one-sided t-tests. So we're just trying to separate whether these herbicide treatments are different from the untreated check. So the treatments that we used over the course of site year, the different site years, we had a number of different treatments, but this is the suite of herbicides that we had at least 3 to 6 site years on for the data I'm going to show. Most of these are we have six site years. It's just Callisto, Mesotrione, and Dual. We only have 3 site years for right now. So I'm grouping them as either primary broadleaf herbicides. And so we have atrazine, Mesotrione, Cyclophenacil, and Rimsulfuron. And we apply them at typical standard rates for Pennsylvania. So I'm calling that 1x rates. Now that might not be a 1x rate in your region. For instance, and depending on your soils and your cropping system, atrazine might be applied at 1.5 to 2 pounds per acre instead of a pound per acre. Also, some of these are primarily broadleaf herbicides. Some of these herbicides also have some activity on small seeded grasses. Same with the grass herbicides, pendimethalin, metolachlor, dimethylamine, and acetachlor. And so this gives us a suite of different modes of action. And so we have the photosystem II inhibitors, HPPD, PPO, and an ALS inhibitor in this group. And then we also applied these mixes, and we treated them as foundation rates. And so these are half X rates. And so for results, I just to demonstrate kind of what the sites look like, this is the biomass, fall biomass of the untreated check. And so the green bars are the annual ryegrass, red bars are the medium red clover, and they range between 100 and 400 pounds of biomass, which is pretty typical for what we see in these interseeded systems. So for results, just to orient you to these graphs, on the x-axis, the zero is basically the untreated check. And so as you go, the check lines are in 20% increments. So we're either increasing biomass or decreasing biomass. And so this is the data for the broadleaf herbicides on red clover. And you can see that both sildenafil and rimisoxafen, we're not seeing any significant difference. We're seeing some significant decreases in mesotrione, which we would expect, and also about a 20% decrease using a pound of atrazine. And so this is pretty, we would probably expect this. These are shorter lived residual herbicides. These are longer lived residual herbicides. And so this basically is what we would suspect to see. Good news is these grass herbicides on red clover, typically they're clustering around zero, not significantly different. There may be a little bit of metolachlor does have some grass activity, and we're seeing a little bit of injury there. Broadleaf herbicides are the combinations at a foundation rate, with the exception of Lumax, which is a combination of atrazine, mesotrione, and metolachlor. We are seeing the treatments cluster around zero, so not significantly different from the untreated check. Basically couldn't grow red clover using a half rate of Lumax. And so this is the annual ryegrass results laid out the same way. Broadleaf herbicides clustering around zero, with the exception of rimisoxafen, not significantly different from the untreated check. Grass herbicides, we do see, except for permethrin, we saw some decreases in annual ryegrass biomass. Metolachlor, which is a popular grass herbicide and has a longer residual activity, we saw pretty significant decreases. But acetochlor and dimethenamide, you may be able to use if you're willing to accept a little bit of injury. Same thing with the half-X rates. We saw some pretty wide error bars and clustering around zero. So just in conclusion, there's a trade-off. We've been able to identify some residual herbicides that we don't see injury or provide have a little bit of injury, but those are typically herbicides that have shorter residual properties and might not deliver the length of weed control that you need. And certainly some of these longer-lived residuals that are popular in these premixes, we're seeing pretty significant levels of injury. So a farmer really needs to decide if he can get away with shorter-lived residuals and still have the level of weed control that he needs, he may be able to interseed successfully. We see the same thing with annual ryegrass. A few of the seedling shoot inhibitors may be able to use with a little bit of moderate injury. Of course, metolachlor, a longer-lived residual herbicide, you're typically not going to be able to probably use in an interseeded system. And then finally, we always caution farmers. We're really not dealing in Pennsylvania with really heavy glyphosate resistance pressure. And but if you're really dealing with resistance and really need long-lived residuals or overlapping residuals, interseeding really might not be viable. And then also, they need to be cognizant of potential to the ability to use these to be able to interseed, you have to use it as a green manure. So some dairy farmers are interested in feeding, using the cover crop as feed or forage, and they're going to be off-label. So it looks like I probably ran out of time.
Thank you very much, Joe. Okay.